The Squawker Talker is brought to you by BetBall, the home of the Squawker Accumulator. This week we're back in City to score over two goals against Crystal Palace, amongst other punts. Check out our acca at the BetBall app. Anyone that follows gets a free £5 bet on the final weekend of the Premier League season, credited on Friday. To get that bonus, go to Squawker's profile on the BetBall app and follow our acca. Minimum stake is £5. Use Squawker's Accumulator or make your own by visiting squawk.at/betball and download the app today. Welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. After a busy week of Champions League and Europa League football and the Premier League weekend ahead, I'm joined today by Nick English. It's been a while, actually, hasn't it?
It's been a very long time. Yeah. I went to the Netherlands and then I went to Wales. Wales was difficult. It was wet. There was no signal. Mm. But I'm back now. So I'm very, very happy to be back.
There's no Welsh Europa League angles that we can come to you later in the pod as a tenuous
No, unless TNS have qualified for next year and I don't know about it.
I haven't checked that. So we'll move on for another pod, another time on Welsh football. Kadeen Simmons is back again. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. I haven't been anywhere apart from like to work in my bedroom. So that's not that exotic, but there were some very interesting travels.
Any thoughts on Welsh football before we begin?
No, not really. I think, as far as I know, TNS went on like a 25-game unbeaten run, won the league comfortably as always. They're a really, really good team, but when it comes to European football, they are awful.
Yeah. I hear Barry Town are back in the top flight next season.
That's good.
Yeah. Should we get on to the Europa League?
Yes.
Moving on now. Tuesday night saw Real Madrid beat Atletico 3-0 in their semi-final first leg in the Champions League. Atletico's mental block kicking again, Nick, or were Real Madrid just the better team?
That's the best I've ever seen Real Madrid play under
Your
Zidane.
You're gobsmacked by how good it was.
It's the best I've ever seen Real Madrid play under Zidane. I know there's this whole like ongoing joke that like Real Madrid under Zidane have just been incredibly lucky. False, by the way. And although there were some very, very small moments of like slices of luck, wafers of luck against Real, they were the better team from the get-go. Zidane had tactically completely outwitted Simeone. Simeone did not expect Isco to be that high up the pitch and did not have a plan for that at all. Tried to react to it by putting on Gaitán early in the second half, which did not work. Zidane moved around his subs, moved it a lot better. I don't think it's a mental block. It's hard to see what you can do in that situation, especially when Toni Kroos and Luka Modric are purring like that. Mm. When the two of them play well in midfield, when they're sort of freed up by someone like Casemiro, who also had a good game, Atletico was second best. I mean, the way Benzema bodied Godin
that was ridiculous.
For Ronaldo's second was embarrassing for a defender of Godin's quality, and maybe signals a bit of a decline for him on that front. You look at the Atletico squad and you kind of think, you know, how many of these players can step it up another level? Can they get to Real Madrid's levels? I know we're going to talk about Juve's level.
Well, isn't the problem that they have stepped up for so long and it's kind of been an unsustainable rise of, you know, unity and adrenaline under Simeone, and they just, you can't keep that up when you're basically financially mismatched against a side like Real Madrid.
Yeah, I think Nick touched upon it, you know, they were just an absolute tactical masterclass. And you know, people have always said that this Madrid team under Zidane is just full of Galacticos. You know, you're going to win most of your games because you've got Ronaldo, Benzema, Bale. But what he's done is there's a real plan, a real sense of tactics behind it. And Isco was just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of talk of when Bale's fit, Bale has to play. But they're a bit more predictable under Zidane when Bale's playing. Isco was just flying all over the place. You couldn't pick him up. He was dropping deep. He was, you know, playing as a striker at one point. Ronaldo was dropping deep. And Atletico were just looking around and just couldn't find anyone to mark because everyone was moving. And I think I think it might be the second goal where Benzema just turned into the Hulk and just, you know, Godin down to the floor, like, don't even come near me ever again. And it was just a quality finish from Ronaldo. Ronaldo had, like, three or four chances, took them all and was just...
Another hat trick.
Yeah.
I think there's a clip of just the third goal, and as Ronaldo's running, it's like hat trick, nope, hat trick, nope. Yep, there's the hat trick.
There it is.
They saw it coming, and I think Atletico didn't see it coming at all, and they will be very disappointed by that.
42nd hat trick for Real Madrid now.
Ridiculous, that isn't it?
Is
I kind of
absurd.
Don't know what more to say about Ronaldo. It's just he is what he is, and it's just he's phenomenal. He's
that sort
phenomenal.
Of claim that he's the best goal scorer in history is getting truer the older he gets. His finishing's just getting better. His ability to make small bursts of movements inside the box. He's an incredible footballer.
And last season, we were all told that, oh, we can do it. We've done it in the big games. Mm. Well, Champions League semi-final against one of your main rivals. Mm. Pretty big, pretty big. We wasn't bad in the quarterfinals either. But Isco for against Atletico, this is the same trick that Zidane pulled on Simeone previously. And Simeone is hailed as this brilliant, reactive defensive tactician. I'm pretty sure that ended 3-0 with Ronaldo hat-trick as well the other time.
Yeah.
With Isco playing behind Ronaldo. A slightly different setup because obviously Benzema wasn't playing that game. But yeah, I'm not saying Simeone is overrated, but Zidane certainly is overrated. We both talked there about his tactics and how he got it right. Why doesn't he get the credit? Is it just the case that he's got a squad so good that people don't see the work that he does?
He's got a great squad, which was a bit assembled by accident in many ways, that he's not particularly responsible for, but he's got a great squad. But as ever, the challenge with these sort of massive squads, like sort of overflowing with talent, is how to manage it and how to get the best of. Mm. It's very easy to forget that, you know, Zidane has been pretty insistent on putting Casemiro in holding midfield, you know, at a time when most, you know, Real Madrid fans were like, no, it's Toni Kroos and it's Luka Modric and it's nothing else, thank you, 4-2-3-1. That's the best setup for this team. Probably the most... Simeone hasn't got the tools that he did a few years ago. He hasn't got the same like caliber of player, maybe.
He's upgraded, though, hasn't he? He's got guys like Gaetan.
Yeah, he's upgraded certain areas, but, you know, they're still a bit, especially in the midfield areas, which is where the Real Madrid really won the game. Mm. You could tell that they lacked a real elite performer, someone who could just grab the game. The most impressive, actually, aspect of the game for me and what really set apart Real Madrid is the in-game management. So at 1-0, it was 1-0 after the ninth minute, and they just cruised, shut the game down, really just moved the ball about.
100 passes, 96% pass accuracy.
Yeah, ridiculous. Toni Kroos, unbelievable. And he was almost playing left back. Like, he was just doing like interplay with Marcelo. Mm. And
he made 10 crosses as well.
Yeah, so and they just weren't, Atletico weren't expecting that at all. But as soon as Real Madrid got the second goal, they just went for the throat. They were like, we can kill this tie now. And like the mentality to do that in such a high-profile game while keeping control, I mean, that was amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, just the belief of the players is incredible.
Again, the flip side, though, it almost seemed like Simeone, to some extent, thought, well, we need to get a goal here. And it did open up a little bit. Was that the biggest mistake he could have made? Because they're 3-0 down. It doesn't matter how good they're going to be defensively at home. They're not going to come back from this, are they?
I think he probably realised that, you know, at 1-2-0, we do need an away goal because you can't... Then, yeah, the away goal would have been so massive. Even at 3-1, you know, we can, you know, bring them back to our place and not nick a 2-0, but if you're going to bet on any team to comfortably win 2-0, Atletico could do it. However, which is why they needed that goal, because now it's game over.
Yeah,
they're not going to outscore Madrid and keep a clean sheet. So,
Especially as Madrid can sort of rotate their defenders and just put their most robust team and put Casemiro in front of them, even Kovacic, just to rotate the ball as an extra midfielder and then just shut things down quite easily. They've got the players to do it.
It's a shame that, well, in some extent, I guess, Atletico didn't have the players to do it, because in the second leg of their game against Leicester City, they played Jose Jimenez in midfield, and I think he did like 27 defensive actions, which is more than some midfielders do in a year.
Mm. Yeah.
And it was just incredible. So, I mean, he wasn't able to play. If he would have been able to play, could that have maybe been a difference for Atletico?
The thing is that because Toni Kroos sort of played so deep and to the left, he would have been tracking Isco or Modric, and he's not mobile enough to do that. What worked for Jimenez against Leicester is that he was either tracking Ndidi or tracking the inside runs of Mahrez, who's not as quick as you might think, Riyad Mahrez, so it was a lot easier for him to do.
Fair enough. Well, if that's going to be one tie pretty much decided, is that also the case of Monaco versus Juventus? Juventus won 2-0 away on Wednesday night. Obviously, this is the side that beat Barcelona 3-0 at home and then went to Camp Nou and shut them down 0-0. It's looking a little bit like an Everest to climb for Monaco now, isn't it, Kadeem?
Yeah, and it's a real shame. I think everyone thought this game would be a bit closer. Simply, you know, as I said, it was Monaco could score for fun, Juventus to keep clean sheets for fun. Which one is going to give? And it's Monaco. And yeah, it is a shame because such a young team, and they were... Everyone's like second team this season. Everyone wanted Monaco to really do well. But
Mbappe they, Union.
Yeah, but they came up against an absolute solid brick wall. Mm. And when they couldn't get past the defence, or when they did get past the defence, they found Buffon, who you could just gush about him all day, can't you? Mm. He's just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. We've had a question from Across the Keeper, actually, on Twitter, who asks, is Buffon the best ever goalkeeper? And if not, who is and why?
Buffon is the best ever goalkeeper because he's done it in like three different eras and the game has moved on a lot. The balls have gotten lighter, the players have gotten quicker, and he still managed to be a dominant force. He had like one wobbly season and, you know, he managed to come out the back of it. I think it was in 2007-08. He was really struggling for form, came out the back of it better. For a country that produces so many amazing keepers, he's always been the best out of the crop. He organises the defence well. He's brilliant at crosses. His game management's fantastic.
Kadeem, you said that it's basically like it was to some extent an immovable object of Juventus' defence versus the unstoppable force, or the once unstoppable force, of Monaco's attack. How did they shut them down? What was the deciding factor to just basically take away the firepower that Hardim's side have relied on?
I don't know. You could look back at it and say, you know, how they do it, but they've done it against Barcelona as well. And Barcelona are another team that, when they want to, can score. Mm. It's just, and sound really cliche, it's just really good organisation. You know, you've got a team or a back three or five or whatever formation they want to play that seem to know each other like the back of their hand. And you can try and run in behind them, but someone's always there to pick you up. Or, you know, they'll let you run in behind because they know that they'll stop the first ball getting to you and stuff like that. And what's been amazing is how Dani Alves has come in this season and just seamlessly slotted in. You would think he's been there for the past 10, 15 years.
But he's now got more assists in the Champions League than any other player since 2011.
Created more chances than any player in the Champions League this season. And I mean, what's interesting is how Allegri's used Dani Alves, because against Barcelona, he played a back four and used Dani Alves as sort of like defensive capacity to basically just kick Neymar for 180 minutes, which worked really, really well. But because Monaco's a very different threat and they can get in behind, he went, OK, I'll go back to my back three. I'll bring Andrea Barzagli in, who's probably the best positionally out of Bonucci, Chiellini and Barzagli.
And he's 35 as well.
And
he's
Mr. Territory. And he said, well, but I'm going to use Dani Alves to sort of push on. And Dani Alves got both assists, you know, playing on the break. And that, when you play a back three, it's really, really hard to play in behind. It was a really mature, solid performance from Juventus. They did an incredible job of shutting down Monaco. They got a few chances, but as we said, like, Buffon just gobbled them up. You know, it's you really have to play very, very well to beat Juventus. That's the key.
And it's not just Dani Alves. Down the left, you've got Alexandro as well. And ahead of him, Mario Mandzukic. We talked on the pod previously about what he does. He's kind of a striker turned like a defensive winger, isn't it? It's a very strange but very effective setup they've got there. But that's on Juventus. Was this a sobering night for Monaco to some extent? Or would that be to overplay what was just a good team coming against a very good team?
Yeah, I think that's it. I'd agree with that. It's a really, really exciting, fun team, Monaco. Who have been riding a bit of luck and riding like an incredible wave of confidence against an incredibly good team in all departments. Monaco do not have they have one defender, that's Kamil Glick. The rest just bomb on. Like, I get it strategically, but in these sort of, we've seen like really gung-ho teams like sort of get picked apart at this stage, typically by like defensive masterclasses by either Atletico or Juventus or sometimes Bayern Munich when they were under Henkes. It's, you know, Juventus are the better team. I expect them to go through personally. It's a shame that Monaco will probably go out going to the Juventus Stadium needing a win. A 3-0 win is...
Ouch.
Yeah.
But then if any team this season is going to do something ridiculous like that, if not Barcelona, it's probably going
to
be Monaco.
True, but you back Allegri to set up his team in the right fashion to sort of nullify Monaco's threat. I mean,
Dani Alves back on kicking duty.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But just, I mean, we've said that it would be unfair to hold this against Monaco, but we know how fickle pretty much everyone in football can be. Did last night cast any doubts on players like Bakayoko? They've been highlighted as like the players to watch this summer in the transfer window. Didn't have a great game.
I think it casts doubt on them if you've never seen them play before and you basically spent this season watching them on YouTube, Twitter highlights. You know, if you spent time watching this Monaco team, you know they are a very good team with very, very good players. And shock, sometimes you have an off night. It's going to happen. You know, take nothing away from that whole team. on this journey that they've been on and will continue to go on, they will have off nights. To try and say that they're not good players off it is just shows a really limited knowledge of football, I guess. I don't think there's any excuse these days to not watch a team like Monaco, given how much they are on TV, how much they've been in the Champions League as well. And it was just an off night. They might have another off night next week, but that doesn't mean they're still not brilliant, brilliant players with amazing futures.
Going in, fair enough.
Yeah. Also, there's a lot of players in that team which are not one-dimensional, but they have a very specific skill set, like Bakayoko. And if the team doesn't play to that skill set or the other team exposes it, they can look a bit ordinary. Mm. Players like Sidibe, as exciting as he is, and Bakayoko.
But it is all about how they all cover each other and how it all fits together.
Exactly. Bernardo Silva got made to look pretty pedestrian against Juve, and that's because, you know, they looked at him and said he's 4'3", like he's going to get bodied. And that's basically what they did for 90 minutes. It's, you know, when you look at football like that, it does get a little bit simpler, but you need the tools to do the job. And Allegri has the tools to really shut down Monaco.
Well, as we're going to probably get into it a little bit later on, Juve pretty much wrap up their sixth straight Italian title this weekend in Serie A. Matt Brownycake has asked, not just last night in the Champions League, this week in the Champions League, and in this season generally, but overall over the last few years, why are Juve so strong? Is it to do with their managers, their players, their system, the backroom staff, their scouts, or is it kind of a fine balance of all?
Job lot, really, isn't it? I mean, it helps that they've got a huge amount of money. The way that they recovered from the Calciopoli scandal and being relegated to Serie B was very, very good. They managed to hold on to some key players, especially guys like Buffon, who can inspire younger players in the project. The recruitment's been exceptional. The Italian transfer system does favour clubs like Juventus. They do favour that sort of thing, especially the whole loan system. But they've recruited very smart. Cuadrado's been an excellent addition to the team. Pjanic has been, you know, an excellent replacement for Pogba.
Slightly slow start, but he's coming to his own now.
He's fantastic. And Allegri's been saying in the press that, you know, he gets frustrated with himself when he misplaces a pass and he needs to work on that. But if that's the main problem that you have with your session, that's great. The real issue for Juventus is going to be, like, how do they blood a new generation of defenders? Because it's, you know, Leonardo Bonucci, initially when he joined Juve, was a bit of a disaster zone, playing in a back two. And then they moved to a back three, and that worked very, very well for him. And it's worked well for Chiellini and Barzagli as well. What do they do when all of those players sort of shuffle on? They need...
Wow. They've got Regani in the wings, and they've also got Caldari, who's been very good at Atalanta this season. So maybe that is one to watch. Interesting thing to see how they do evolve, though. But looking at Juventus and how they dominated Italy, it kind of looks a little bit like how Bayern Munich dominated Germany for quite some years, and still are, really. Are there any lessons from the big clubs in England looking at what Juventus are doing? The kind of efficiency about how they go about everything that they can learn. I'm kind of thinking teams like Man United, maybe.
If you're a team like Man United and you've got a really, really good young player, I don't know, let's call him Paul Pogba, how about you don't let him go in a free transfer to a massive team in Europe? I think...
The degree of wastage is just incredible, isn't it?
It is, though. It's you look at stuff like that and you're just like, how? I think part of it, and I think if you talk about Man United, is they've had some really, really good players at the wrong time. So in the sense that they had Gerard Piqué at a time when they had Vidic and Ferdinand and he was not going to play. They had Giuseppe Rossi, who is one of my favourite strikers. And they've always had this really good...
A man of pure tragedy in a football sense. Yeah. So sad.
Knees made of crackers.
Yeah, but again, I think we touched upon it last time I was on, I think. You look at Michael Keane, who was not going to get into the United team, was it last season or the season before? But he's gone away and he's kind of learned his trade. And I think what teams like United and other Premier League teams need to do is just utilise the loan system. Stop selling these players if you think, you know, they're not going to play the season, so I'm going to sell them for 2-3 million. Loan them out or put a buyback clause in the contract. That's what teams in Italy, Spain do exceptionally well. They say, fine, you know.
And it's kind of what Chelsea and Man City are doing well as well.
Yeah, okay, you can buy this player, but if you're going to sell him on, we get first refusal. That's what teams need to start doing, and I'm shocked they haven't been doing it for years.
Well, we're going to get onto United a little bit more very shortly, and other Premier League teams. But before we move on from the Champions League, I want to know, with Real Madrid and Juventus in full control going to the second legs, do you reckon this is the final or decided who's going to be in it?
I hope so, because I really want to see a Real Madrid-Juve final. A, because two of the best managers in Europe in terms of tactically and in-game management right now. And B, just there's a really good balance to a game like that. You know, there's loads of narrative all over the shop as well.
Two proper, genuine heavyweights of European football as well.
Massive heavyweights. Buffon, could Buffon win his first Champions League? Be a great story.
Well, we have a question on that. Matt Brownikick is back again off Twitter. Ooh. And he wants to know, would you rather Real Madrid win, will retain the Champions League, become the first side to ever retain the Champions League, with Zidane winning it in his, you know, all the rest of that, or would you rather Buffon finally wins the Champions League? Which narrative would you like, Kadeem?
Buffon. I think seeing the team retain the Champions League would be really, really nice, but I think it depends on that team and who they're going up against. Mm. And it's all about Buffon. I'm sorry. It would be really, really nice for him to finally win it, given how he'd been so close before. And I think even the fact that when Juve got relegated, he stayed with them. Kind of, it would just be like the icing of the cake of that story in general. You know,
the big payoff.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many players in that Juventus squad that you want to see win a Champions League. Giorgio Chiellini, who he forgave a man for biting him, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Like, what a dude. Like, what an absolute legend. Higuain, the perennial loser, you know, who, by the way, against Monaco had a rubbish game but buried two chances with the complete opposite of what he normally does.
That's what you want from your poacher, isn't it?
That's what you want from your poacher. You know, Dybala, like, imagine what that could do for his confidence.
He didn't score two goals the other night, but he did do that incredible little back heel.
That's beautiful.
That was buff. Dani Alves. Like, Dani Alves, great guy, like, great servant for Barcelona. Got,
is he the most decorated active player in Europe or something?
He might well be, or it could be Patrice Evra.
Maybe Maxwell. Maxwell's got loads of trophies because he's just kind of...
I don't know if Dani Alves has got a World Cup, though. I don't think he was involved. So
I think in terms of club football, he's probably...
All right, okay. Might be Philip Lahm in this case.
Yeah.
Maybe.
A fullback by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Not a striker. It's probably a fullback.
Yeah, we've been spoiled for fullbacks.
Staying in Europe, just very shortly, Europa League was also on this week. Wednesday night saw Ajax score four goals against Lyon, who got their little consolation goal, but another tie, which, unless Ajax kind of throw it away, this looks over. But then Ajax could throw it away, couldn't they? Because in their last round, in the quarterfinals, they took it pretty close against Schalke in the end, didn't they, Nick?
Yeah, well, I think they learned a lesson from the Schalke game, which is they stopped attacking and then realised, core, defensively, we're not great. And if anybody watches the Eredivisie... if anybody watches the Eredivisie regularly, you'll know that the defending is awful, awful, awful. This is why strikers who come from the Eredivisie, they're like, he scored 60 billion goals. And then it turns out to be Memphis Depay. No offence.
Luis Suarez?
But there's the exception which proves every rule. Ruud van Nistelrooy?
Vincent Janssen?
Yeah, all day. Robin van Persie. There's Afonso Alves. Don't forget him.
Rocky Van Wolfswinkel?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, God, that was bad.
We've got a nice mix of goods and bads there.
Good and bad. But this is the thing, is that the actual... the actual number of goals they score in the Eredivisie isn't an indicator of quality. And Ajax basically just sort of realised this after the Schalke game and just kept attacking. It was ridiculous. Like, it could have been 7-3, like, in the end. Ajax were relentless.
But then if goals aren't a sign of quality in the Eredivisie, then four goals past Lyon in the Europa League is pretty much a sign of quality, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. It's Lyon are good, but when I saw the scoreline, I was like, okay... and kind of kept on doing what I was doing.
They are two sides that like to attack rather than defend.
It's not like they put four past Juventus. It's four past a side who are okay defending. And if you get that one night where everything clicks for you, and I think it helps me take about 50 shots on goal. But, you know, sometimes you get a night where you just keep scoring. And I think that night was Wednesday night for Ajax.
In some ways, Ajax didn't, because they could probably have scored seven goals with the chances they had.
Yeah, I mean, it was Ajax's night, really. There was the big ceremony for Johan Cruyff, because they're renaming the Amsterdam Arena the Johan Cruyff Arena. Terrible name, by the way. Just call it the Johan Cruyff Stadium or something. Why Arena? Anyway. and Lyon absolutely bottled it. I don't know if it was the fans or something or whatever, but... as soon as that second goal went in, Kasper Dolberg with a lovely outside of the foot finish, the fans went absolutely, like,
I think we watched it together.
There were,
on screen, there were five very large, fat Dutch men without their tops on, climbing on each other.
Yeah. Literally climbing all over each other. It was complete
chaos.
It's
like a human pyramid in the wind.
It was but, you know, Ajax just completely outpressed Lyon and made it very, very difficult for them to sort of...
Hakim Ziyech.
Great little player.
Who else excites you in this side, actually? Just while we're here.
I mean, they all do. It's more about the team as a whole, really, than anything. And what they've really done very, very well is, you know, go back to sort of their roots almost, believing in young talent, putting the system above the names. You know, Kasper Dolberg's a very interesting player, but
De Ligt was like, what, he's 17, isn't he?
Yeah, playing, like... you know, it's great. It's great to see, and it's great to see like Ajax sort of become a force. And it looks like they're going to go to the final, yeah, which is fantastic.
Their first one in a long
time. Ages, the first European final since 1997.
Wow, yeah. Wow. And it is great to see them back up there because a side with so much history that we talk about with Real Madrid and Juventus. But on Thursday night, another side with a bit of history in Europe, Man United went away to Celta Vigo and got a 1-0 win. Marcus Rashford getting the goal. Got a bit of a knock that was taken off. Not sure if he's going to play against Arsenal at the weekend. But he's back again playing after a slow start, scoring the goals. I think he's now got more in every competition he did last season. Okay, he played more games. But there's been a bit of talk over whether he's been managed correctly this season. Do you think that Mourinho's done well by him? Like playing him out wide, giving him a bit of experience, doing something different, and then bringing him in when Ibrahimovic hasn't been available? We have actually had a direct question on this. Thomas Shanahan asks, how good is Marcus Rashford? How good can he be? And has Jose helped his development this season?
I think he's been managed brilliantly. I think in the past you've seen young English players burst on the scene one season, the next season play 60 games, and then a few years down the line everyone's like, why do these people keep on getting injured and are really, really tired? I think bringing in Ibrahimovic was a really good move. I think Rashford has said himself he's learned a lot from having Zlatan around. Plus, it's allowed Jose to keep him on the bench a bit more, you know, not burn him out and not use him as much as other managers have used young British talent. I think this is the way they should be brought up. Don't chuck them in at the deep end straight away because they actually get early injuries, burnout, and
loss of confidence as well.
Yeah, I think it's been a real good handling of the situation by Mourinho, which is quite interesting. Everyone says he doesn't play young players, he doesn't trust them, but if they're good enough, or in Rashford's case, he's been good enough to earn the trust of Jose over players like Martial, Mkhitaryan at first, and Wayne Rooney when he's fit, I guess.
Kind of a similar situation to what happened with Varane at Real Madrid under Mourinho. He's got a player who, despite his age, Mourinho likes to play with experienced players, but this guy he's got the right attitude, he's got the right work rate. He's pretty good, isn't he?
He's got the lot. I mean, he can play with the ball over the top, play with the ball to feet. Great feet. His hold up play this season has been exceptional, either playing on the left or through the middle. His work rate is phenomenal. His pace, I mean,
some of the flicks as well. I think there's one point where the ball gets played to him out on the left, and he flicks around the defender, and he's gone, and you can't catch him.
He's gone. Even Hector Bellerin can't keep up with him.
Yeah, the flick against Man City as well. He loves a flick over someone's head, and he's got the skill to do it, and the pace to then get away from the defender or midfielder, and it makes a massive, massive difference.
Yeah. Another player with the skill and a bit of everything, Paul Pogba. Might have heard of him. He returned to action and basically made United look like they had a midfield again. Is it a problem that United are so reliant on him? Is that just part of the charm of having a player as individually impressive as he is, or is it unhealthy?
I don't think it's unhealthy. I think when you pay this much money for a player, he's doing what he was brought to do. And there's been a lot of... I think I saw a tweet a few weeks ago saying that, like, Gary Cahill scored more goals than Paul Pogba this season. It's like, okay, good for Gary Cahill, but Paul Pogba's game isn't about goals. And I think that's what a lot of pundits, fans need to realise. Pogba isn't going to get you 20 goals a season. That doesn't mean he shouldn't cost you 89 million, because as he shows when he's on the pitch, he's amazing. And kind of a side note, how does Pogba get injured and then come back and play 90 minutes? I'm really astounded by that. It's like,
as a physical specimen, like, he's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't know many 6'3" guys that can sprint that fast and then play 90 minutes at that pace, like, without any issue. And like the when he gets fouled, it's like it takes a lot to bring him down. He's a big lad. I find it quite interesting that he always seems to play much better in the Europa League than he does in the Premier League. I wonder if there's something like, there's an adjustment there. But so much of Paul Pogba's season has been defined by like near misses and like stuff that he's tried that's not quite come off. Little moments here and there where it's just like, it's not quite there. And I think that next season, he's going to absolutely explode. Mm. Like,
we're saying that we don't expect him to score 20 goals a season, but maybe in terms of assists, you expect his contribution to the team to provide the goals for somebody else to score 20 goals a season. He's only got 3 in the league this year. He's only got 1 in the Europa League so far. But I did run the numbers last night after the Celta Vigo game. And if United can converted his chances to the same rate that City converted De Bruyne's, Pogba would have 11 assists this season. If it was Fabregas, I think 16 assists. Looking at the some of the more advanced stuff that's out there, I think by expected assists, he's fourth in the league, second only to De Bruyne for midfielders. I think I might have to check that a bit later on, but that was true.
Doesn't surprise me at all. And he's playing much deeper than De Bruyne would, and he's got much more responsibility in the team than someone like Fabregas would. And
second most successful through balls in the league as well.
Yeah, and he's also playing in a worse team than City and Chelsea.
But this is kind of what I was getting at, that United are so dependent on him that it almost puts too much responsibility on him. What do they need to do to make sure that he's more free to actually see people score his goals for him and kind of let him play next season?
Well, I can't have it both ways. That's what they wanted, right? Yeah. You spend £90 million on a player, you could have had two £45 million players for that. Sorry, but you either get Paul Pogba or you get 3 Pjanic's. It's up to you. Like, you know. If Jose Mourinho thought Paul Pogba was the one midfielder that he needed, so he got Paul Pogba. If he's now going to complain that the team's too reliant on Paul Pogba, I can't play without them, then I'm sorry, that's tough cheese. Is that an expression?
It can be, and it is now.
Yeah.
Ryan Baldy asked off Twitter, Carrick and Herrera's performances in the midfield role this season and last night, has that changed Mourinho's mind, you think, about the profile of player he needs to be playing in defensive midfield next season? And will it change his targets in the summer?
Possibly. I think Carrick. I think he might be able to get another season out of Carrick.
He's looked very leggy recently. Though.
Yeah.
You're talking about him like he's like a already squeezed lemon on the countertop, and he just found him 2 days later, being like, "I can bet a bit more out of this."
I think it's going to be.
I think that is actually a very good analogy.
Yeah, it is. United will be in Europe next year, whether it's the Europa League or the Premier League. I think what he has found is that he can't play Fellaini in that Carrick role. It's like, just don't do it. Please stop doing it. Like, just don't try it again. If United are going to replace Carrick with someone, I think it could be Fabregas. I think.
Ooh.
Okay.
I don't know. I just think I love what Fabregas, as a player, Fabregas is one of my favourite players. He's absolutely brilliant. Jose brought him in at Chelsea. There's talk that Fabregas, wants to leave Chelsea.
It makes sense where you'd have the tackler in Herrera, who can play a bit.
Yeah.
You'd have Pogba, basically the doer, the guy who gets forward, dribbles and makes things happen. And then you've got the ball sponge, which is Fabregas.
Yeah, I think, off the top of my head, I can't think of anyone else that United will look to bring in. They probably will bring someone else. But no, I think Fabregas would fit in at United. His family could probably do what Jose's family do and stay in London. And, he'll just commute or do their work around it.
Basically, it all depends on HS2.
Possibly, yeah.
I think you, Mourinho is probably looking at his squad and thinking, I need another bastard in here, in his midfield. Be fine. he's thinking, I need someone else who can destroy that, because he's sort of turned Herrera into the sort of niggly, tackly guy, but he hasn't really got someone else. Marouane Fellaini is just violent, so that doesn't really count.
It's not controlled aggression, that's the issue.
He needs someone else that's got that controlled aggression that he used to really like. Jose Mourinho size, like Esteban Cambiaso at Inter when they were so defensively dominant. He likes someone who's really, really awful, and right now he's got Herrera who's sort of doing that, but it's sort
even of, he hasn't got that kind of cool-headed, cynicalness. He's still a bit fiery.
Yeah, he's the sort of guy stamps on you, then dives, and it's all very cheeky and snide. But you need someone who's just a ruthless killer in midfield. Yeah. You feel like he wants that, and I don't think Fabregas would be that role. Although another passer is also important because Carrick's on the way out.
But other guys talked about guys like Bakayoko again.
Yeah, I think he needs a really nasty player. He needs a smarter Fellaini. There's something really fascinating about Fellaini that Fellaini will get booked, and to everyone else on the pitch, in the stand, it's like, okay, for the next few minutes, calm down and don't do anything stupid. And Fellaini's like, that was really fun. I want to do it again. It's like,
maybe I could draw blood this time.
Yeah, he's got like a little, those dart sharpeners.
Yeah.
He's got like one of those for his elbows. It's just like, here we go, yellow cards. See what I could get away with.
But I think even yesterday, you picked up a booking, and towards the end of the game, you start fouling a bit, and you're just going, you're going to get sent off again, aren't you? And there's a real arch,
He thinks he's Wanyama and he's not Wanyama.
Yeah. I think to kind of feign a coin a phrase from Harry Potter, you need like a master of the dark arts. Dark arts. And it's not Fellaini. So yeah, he needs to go out and get one of those. But he also needs a bit more squad depth.
They should have just bought Moussa Dembélé 2 seasons ago. Oh, I don't know why that didn't happen. That seemed like the most obvious transfer for United to do.
It really did. It made a lot of sense when he basically took them apart for Fulham. Was like, what I could do for you.
I was just about to say, with like, you know, I'm going to tear you apart for Fulham. Everyone's like, oh, United should sign this player. No, I'm going to sign for Tottenham and then play the following week and do it again. And everyone was like, Fergie, did you not just see that?
and ultimately, that's the kind of player that Pogba's been signed to be. And that's a very expensive way of doing that. And before we move on, just looking at all the scores, is this the only tie that could end up in an upset still?
Nah. I don't think...
Going to hammer them at Old Trafford.
Yeah, I don't think Celta offered a lot, honestly. You know, it was a moment of magic which won the game and provoked incredible debate.
We'll get onto that later.
We'll get onto that, okay. Incredible debate on TalkSport. But I think if, you know, this is the other thing in terms of Rashford's abilities. He's also got a moment of magic in him. Mm. He can make something out of nothing. And I think United have got more of that than Celta Vigo did. It was a classic Mourinho 1-0 away performance. And now he's going to go to Old Trafford and be like, go on then, score. Mm. You know. See how you like it.
Well, he's going to be going to the Emirates this weekend, but we're going to quickly fly through the Premier League fixtures. On Friday night, which is, we're recording Friday morning, so it's upon us already, Spurs travel to West Ham. Spurs already top of the mini table for all London teams this season, regardless of what happens at the London Stadium. And what do you think this record says about their dominance over the capital and their qualities and weaknesses?
I think that's a really good question. It's been a really weird season in London. You've had Chelsea do really well kind of against everyone else. Arsenal have just been Arsenal. Like they managed to Arsenal and it's brilliant to watch.
They've in Arsenal-ceptioned it, haven't they?
Yeah, and West Ham kind of been not really good, neither Watford, I guess. Tottenham have just been really, really consistent, but in a really fun and exciting way.
Mm. Well, Pochettino, he's a guy who loves the derbies. He's talked about them all the time. But yeah, I mean, it's too much to say that they're a team that rely on like an adrenaline rush to play well, because they don't. But I don't know. I just look at this and what more do they have to do to kind of, if they're beating Chelsea on local turf, if you know what I mean, what more do they have to do to kind of take that next step nationally, if you will?
Win more games.
But is it just a case of squad depth or?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, that's it.
This became a really straightforward question to answer, didn't it?
That's what happened in the Champions League, right?
Yeah.
That's what happened in the Champions League. You know, they've been dining off their White Hart Lane form for 2 or 3 seasons under Pochettino now. Next season's going to be a bit weird for them, not just because it's Wembley and they seem to have a weird mental block there, but also for the fact that, imagine you're Scott Dan, right? And you're playing for Crystal Palace and you're going to Wembley. That's your only chance of going to Wembley and playing there. You're going to play out of your skin.
So that was actually my dream last night. So it's funny you say that. I was Scott Dan at Wembley.
They're going to have that all season, Spurs, next season. So they need to... They've taken a massive step up every season that Pochettino's been in charge, and they're so impressive to watch. And I think they're going to batter West Ham, by the way. And I think that next season they need to get another step up, because it's a really awkward situation they're in with this whole Wembley Stadium thing, because teams are going to come there and want to beat them. That's pretty much it.
But West Ham are another side that love a derby. They obviously raised their game to beat Chelsea, the first side to beat Chelsea since their switch to 3-4-2-1 way back in October in the EFL Cup. Is there any way they can get one over on Spurs? Spurs are under pressure to some extent. They win this, they're a point behind Chelsea in the title race, all to play for, but you know, it's all on them, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think my problem with West Ham is that you look at their team and it feels like it's a bunch of Pro Evolution players before you do the edit and make them real. So you look at a bunch of the names and you're just like, who are you? I think I saw the squad list, they played a few weeks ago, and I saw the list and I was like, who are these players? They've got players who I have never heard of.
Master League specialists.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of their problem. You know, and I'm not saying they need a bunch of, you know, glitz and glamour names to do really, really well, but they've just got a bunch of players who they just kind of just picked up over the past few years without anyone really realising it.
Haven't got that unity they had last year.
No, not at all. Part of it is that so many injuries, Shock, Hovo, Andy Carroll.
But Bilic, I think we were in the press conference together, actually. It was after one of those big losses he suffered so many times this season, where he said that the intensity's just gone in training. He doesn't want to get it back.
They've suffered from Mark Noble's massive downward spiral in form that was really unexpected. Mm. Like, Mark Noble was quietly one of the better midfielders in the league for the past three seasons, and this season he's been abhorrent.
But he put so much into last year. I wonder, when we talk about this mental block at Wembley for Spurs, I wonder if going to London Stadium is not so much a technical thing, it's more just, it's just a distraction. It just breaks up your routine.
But also it's the same thing, I think, teams want to go to the London Stadium and say, oh, you've got your big new fancy stadium that you got on the cheat. We want to buy you. Like, I can see that.
But I think it's funny, the word big, London Stadium and Wembley, the big stadium, the big pitches. Mm. And if you don't adapt to that and adapt to that quickly and use it to your advantage, some teams will pick you apart, or they will just kind of alter their game plan in a very different, in a very sly way, which you don't really realise. Mm. And I think that's part of Tottenham's problem, part of West Ham's problem when they're playing at Wembley and, you know, London Stadium respectively. West Ham haven't adapted to the London Stadium. Mm. When you watch them there, it still feels like they're kind of looking around going, there's so much space, what do we do with it? And they don't have those players to kind of like drop deep or drop back a bit to link up the players. Mm. It's like, you know, let's start going long to Andy Carroll. Oh wait, Andy Carroll is back at home because he's injured again. Mm. And yeah, it hasn't really worked. They don't seem to have a system to play at the London Stadium.
So we're pretty much expecting Spurs to run them over.
Yeah.
God, yeah. The Spurs are so good. I mean, the way they played against Arsenal in the North London Derby is ridiculous. Mm. They completely steamrolled them.
And they're kind of in the form of their lives this season as well. But Chelsea don't play it until Monday. So if Spurs do win, there's a few days for Conte's team to kind of mull it over before they take on Middlesbrough. Mm. And we're going to come to that match on Monday when we do the next podcast. So it makes a bit more sense. Flying back through the rest of the Premier League, the relegation battle sees Hull City host Sunderland on Saturday. Sunderland already relegated, while Swansea host Everton. Advantage to the Tigers on that one?
Yeah. Hugely.
Which club out of those two do you reckon make the most of it in the Championship, make the best of going down?
What, Sunderland or Swansea?
Yeah. Swansea or Hull City.
It's difficult to say. The problem with Hull is that they really need to stay in the Premier League because they've got such a paper-thin squad.
And their owner's not sure whether they're into it or not.
Yeah, the owner's not sure if he's staying or leaving, and they've really lucked out with this Marco Silva appointment. But
he's gone.
Yeah, he's got a relegation clause in his contract.
He's also got a one-year contract as well.
Yeah,
Please.
He's sort of built up his reputation, and now he's probably gone. Whereas Swansea, you think Paul Clement will probably stay there. Mm. They've got
experience in the Championship as well.
Yeah, they've got a squad of players. They're known for having really decent academy. They basically have the pick of the Welsh talent, Swansea, because they don't play in the Welsh League with TNS. And Cardiff aren't huge competition for academy.
Surprising thread to this podcast, the Welsh thing.
Sometimes it happens like that. So I think Swansea would do a better job of it. Hull would be in free-fall situation, so they desperately need to stay up.
Mm. Moving on now to the race for the Champions League. Manchester City host Crystal Palace. Do the Eagles have enough to unsettle Guardiola's side? Obviously, he's not a fan of those second balls, is he?
I wouldn't really call it a race. It's more of a, no, please, you go first. Like, no, you go first.
A cue. Yeah, it's the Champions League.
You normally get a situation where teams don't want to go into the Europa League. It's like teams don't want to go into the Champions League this season. Mm. It's like United, you know, win your game in hand and you go, you know, if you go third. No, do you know what? We're going to draw this game and try and do it the hard way. So
They're too polite.
But no, I think Man City should beat Palace. I think Palace, they're not on the beach yet, but they're on the plane to go to the beach because they pretty much know they're safe. And
Big Sam's got the villa booked.
Yeah, and the Speedo's out. And, you know, he's...
Oh, no.
The Speedo's are out. I don't know what Sam offered as a safety bonus to his players, but it must have cost an absolute packet. And it's,
pints of wine.
And it's bloody worked. Yeah. Because they all of a sudden, they came out and they're like, right, we're going to win all the game. Crystal Palace could have won all of their last seven games. They've been really unlucky to not get wins in all of them. They've been unreal. Jason Puncheon is a man reborn. Christian Benteke looks like he actually enjoys kicking balls again. They could cause another upset. I don't know, maybe they just think, like, let's just get
Christian Benteke is kind of... If anyone's going to upset that back line, it's going to be him, isn't it?
Well, Vincent Kompany's fit again, and that's going to be great fun to watch. And they obviously know each other from the Belgian national team. They're both super physical, both really good in the air. So we'll see how that pans out. But
interesting duel. I think, looking ahead to the future.
Sorry. I think what will help is if Townsend and Zaha fancy another big game.
Because City are not strong at fullback.
Yeah, City's back four really hate pacing behind them, and it could be so. Big Sam doesn't really play Route 1 football, but you can kind of see the ball up to Benteke. He'll flick it on to Zaha and Townsend, and that little flick to get past defender, you know, whether it's Otamendi, company, whoever's going to play at the back. And City don't have a goalkeeper. So it's basically like you shoot and it's an open goal.
There's some profile raising for Crystal Palace players. They're going to be like, this squad's too good to go down. And Wilf Zaha will be thinking, hello Spurs, please buy me. Please.
But looking to the future, you've had a couple of questions on City. Rob V4 and David Borland ask, what are the challenges facing Pep next season? And this may be mischievous from David. Has Pep's side actually gone backwards technically over the course of the year? Has he simply tried to do too much with the wrong players?
I agree entirely with the latter part of the second question. That is absolutely spot on. He tried. He had it nailed on, his tactics, in the first part of the season, and then he tried a tweak and it didn't work. And he was like, oh no, go back to what I did before. And that didn't work. And he was like, meh. Sort of just panicked and used all the defenders and then back the hell out of John Stones, even though he probably needed taking out the fire alarm for a little bit longer. Mm. And then back Claudio Bravo, even though it's pretty obvious you should have just recalled Joe Hart.
Don't recall Joe Hart.
Joe Hart's better than Claudio Bravo. Just going to put it out there.
Not with his feet, though.
Out there. Probably not with his feet.
Or his hands either. I'm sorry.
Or his hands. He's got no hands. In terms of the first question, what are the challenges facing Pep next season? Ooh, long list. Why don't you buy some fullbacks? You've had two transfer windows to do it. Stop being so arrogant and buy some fullbacks.
It's not him buying these things, is it, really?
But he needs to demand fullbacks. For some reason, he bought Leroy Sané. Mm. Leroy Sané's been great, right, the past couple of months. He didn't need him. He didn't actually 100% need him.
He's been a good wing back as well.
Yeah, and he didn't need Nolito.
He clearly doesn't need Nolito because he's disappeared, hasn't he?
Yeah, so I don't really understand. And in his heart of hearts, he probably didn't believe that Ilkay Gundogan was a massively essential purchase. Mm. What you really needed was three or four defenders to help out that squad, especially in the fullback department.
I mean, but then it does make you wonder whether it's just like kind of lost in translation between him and the actual directors of football going
maybe,
out and buying things.
So. Maybe, but Pep strikes me as the sort of person who's such a control freak that he wouldn't take on a project unless he had like massive oversight. And I would say he needs to like wake up and do the basics first. He's strolled into other clubs where the squads are just already sorted, and if something doesn't work out, he can change the players around. He's like, oh, actually, yeah, I've got Javier Mascherano who can be like a world class centre back. That's great. You haven't got that at City, mate. Like you've got Bakary Sagna who's like dovetailing. You've got Pablo Zabaleta who's, you know,
he's old.
Who's old and who's a bit creaky. You know, you've got Gael Clichy who's very unreliable.
And Navas isn't a fullback. Like,
yeah. He seems to be wanting to keep him on now, though, doesn't
he? He's got the best out of him.
But
the best isn't great.
Yeah, it's like he's trying to go. So, the team down the road have turned Valencia, a really pacey winger, into a right back. I'm going to do this with Navas. And Navas is like, no. what are you doing to me?
Leave
me alone.
That would be it. Another match in the queue for the top four sees Liverpool take on Southampton at Anfield. Only a wonder goal by Emre Can sorted out their win for them against Watford last week. Sturridge actually looked quite good when he came on for Divock Origi. Is this the time for Klopp to kind of go, are all the players that make that system work are injured or falling away? Should he just kind of give Sturridge the platform to save their season and get them over the line?
He should, but he probably won't. I think Klopp is another one who will try and outsmart himself and try and, you know, tweak something, maybe put Lana up front or something, and it's not going to work. And I think they might have enough to just about beat Southampton, but they'll make it really difficult for themselves. Again, it's this whole Champions League is right enough, you know, the door to Champions League is right there, let's open it. Actually, wait, no, I'm going to run around the block a few times and see if I can, you know, lose some extra pounds. Like, what are you doing? Just open the door and go through it. It's not difficult.
But City and Liverpool are the favourites of the top four at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, probably. I disagree with Kadeem, by the way, on Liverpool. Sorry, mate.
No.
I think Klopp absolutely needs to stick to a system. He just needs to find, I think he needs to keep running around that block to find the other open door. Because essentially the only thing Liverpool struggle with is...
Sounds like a lyric, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, I don't know where I was going with that. Fire in the booth. Essentially what he needs to find is just like a way of breaking down these deep line defences, right? So either he finds a player in the summer who can let him do that.
Well, he can't do that in the running. He can't do that in the running.
But in the running, he just needs to find a way of doing it. I'm surprised he hasn't tried just like telling his team to play deep and then play on the break, because sometimes, as an example, sometimes Arsenal do that against weaker sides and it really unsettles them. Nobody's noticed that Wenger's been doing this for a couple of years.
Give them the ball, see what they do with it.
Yeah, yeah, give them the ball, and like, and they're like, oh, okay, so we get the ball. What do we give? Give Watford the ball for 90 minutes. Like, see what happens.
But they'll try and foul themselves.
Start kicking each other.
You know, he needs to find an alternate solution, because there's so much about Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool that's so great.
But then I guess you don't want to give Southampton the ball. They're one side that are quite good with it, and obviously they beat Liverpool in the semi-finals of the EFL Cup as well.
Yeah, true. I just feel like Liverpool haven't got like the answer to the question that's being posed to them by teams that are slightly lower down the table.
So it is a case of just holding on until the transfer market until they get those answers.
I think so, yeah. But also, you never know. You might find something that works really, really well, whether it's playing a more narrow formation, a wider formation. Just keep trying. Don't change your overall formation.
Tweak rather than
overhaul.
But then didn't he give Lovren a brand new contract?
Oh,
and if he did, I would love to know what that... Like, you know, how do you fix Liverpool? Let's give Lovren more money. It's like, no, that's the last thing you do. It's surely, you know, you bring Saka back in, who, oh my days, he's a really, really good defender. Mm. No, I'm going to give the money I could have given
Saka. It is a real shame we haven't seen Saka and Matip play together.
It is a shame, but... Well, yeah, there's obviously a personal disagreement there.
I'm probably going to come on to later on in the summer as we review the season and look forward to next season as well. And the other game, the big game, I must say, in the queue for the top four is Arsenal versus Manchester United, the two sides that are doing more than anyone to hold the door open for others. Xhaka is reportedly out while Mourinho says he's going to rest players. Do you reckon the spectacle of this, usually a grudge match, will be depleted by just people not being fit?
Yes.
I'm answering very direct questions.
Xhaka being out is a huge loss for Arsenal. He's been very, very good recently.
Well, the 3-4-2-1 has actually suited him quite well. I think Wenger said it's given him more freedom.
The 3-4-2-1 has suited him quite well because it sort of like allows him to just pass the ball around a bit. It's amazing that, I've been saying this in the office a lot recently, but it's amazing that Wenger's gone for a back three before doing a midfield three. Where he's got.
But do you reckon he'll stick with it for this? Because it wasn't great against Spurs.
It wasn't great against Spurs, but honestly speaking, that was, like, I've watched Arsenal a lot this season. That was probably one of their better performances of 2017, that Arsenal performance versus Spurs. They just got absolutely bossed. Spurs were that good, in my opinion. The midfield three would... This is a perfect excuse to play Coquelin, Elneny and Ramsey in a midfield three.
You're the first person with Arsenal kind of interest to say, play Coquelin.
Yeah. I've heard that's, but the Elneny and Ramsey... It's going to be like Coquelin-Ramsey. Do you really want to inflict that on the children? Do the children of Arsenal deserve that? No, they don't. Stop playing a midfield two. You haven't got two midfielders good enough to play midfield two.
Why not stick Bellerin at right wing back and bring Oxlade-Chamberlain side, eh?
Yeah, why not?
Why not?
But in a midfield three. Just stop playing a midfield two. Because if think of it this way. Put Elneny,
so
Ramsey.
Maybe you go 3-5-2 with Sanchez and Giroud up front.
Yeah, or you can play Welbeck.
I think Welbeck should start this game.
Yeah, 4-3-3. You play Welbeck up top. You know, he's the sort of guy that can really cause problems, stretch defences. Sanchez on the left, maybe Walcott on the right. He always scores in big games for Arsenal.
One player I've got to say in this whole mix of players we haven't mentioned is Mesut Ozil. And just given it's Mourinho, it's Man United, it's Ander Herrera, given what he did to Eden Hazard, is that going to be the key battle? Because as much as Ozil maybe hasn't delivered as much as some fans might want, he's still the most of the passes go through him, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, when Arsenal don't have Ozil, any fluidity that does exist, and there's not a lot for Arsenal at the moment, just totally evaporates. Mesut Ozil in midfield three is, you know, what should be happening. The ideal midfield three from Wenger's point of view would probably be Xhaka, Cazorla and Ozil. That's beautiful. You know, when Ozil dropped deep...
Jamie's never tried it, innit?
Yeah, I know, right? when Ozil drops deep and sort of passes the play around the midfield, you know, it's great, but Wenger wants him pushing on. Love to see a midfield three for Arsenal. I think it would really, really work.
Bit of an interesting one for you. If you could swap one player from each squad, because obviously they both got quality all over the place, but they're a bit unbalanced in certain areas. If you could swap one Arsenal player for one Man United player and they basically swap clubs, who would they be and why?
If I was to take one Arsenal player and give them to United and vice versa?
Yeah.
If I was to take one United player, I'd probably give them De Gea. Although in saying that, Cech's been really good the past few weeks, so I'm not too sure. Well, it's a really, really good question.
The idea is to strengthen both sides. So if you leave United without a main goalkeeper, that's
going to be... Although Romero's played really well as well.
So I want you to basically do a part exchange, one player for one player.
And the best part exchange for both teams. Yeah. So sort of like a Gallas Cole situation.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you want to bring that deal back into the minds of Arsenal fans.
Yeah, yeah. It worked for both teams at the time.
Oh.
I would swap Rashford for Rashford to Arsenal, and I would give them Mesut Ozil.
Oof.
That's what I would do.
Reunited with Mourinho at last.
Imagine that.
Well, who's he going to be passing to? Because he haven't got a running attacker anymore.
Slightly better.
Martial, I guess.
Martial, yeah.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I honestly don't know.
Have I stumped you with this one?
This has really stumped me, yeah.
It's a tough one. It really is. Oh, mind you, I think United could do with a solid left-back, so maybe give them Nacho Monreal.
Imagine that.
Inspiring.
I think you could kind of get away with giving...
Koscielny?
They need him just from body count at the moment. So
Koscielny and Bailly would be a good centre-back partnership.
Both running to stop the same fire.
Yep.
Yeah. I honestly have no idea. This is going to stump me for weeks.
I wonder what Mourinho would make of Cocker. I really do.
I'm going to run into the studio in a few weeks and be like, I've got the answer. And you'd be like, what are you on about?
Ooh, Herrera and Ramsey would be an interesting midfield duo.
Ooh.
And Ibrahimovic at Arsenal might just solve a lot
of
problems.
Yeah, he's always, to me, he was like the better Giroud, like the target man who was so awesome and would never quite happen, did it? I think he refused to do a trial, didn't he? Was that the story?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Zlatan doesn't do trials.
So very, very quickly, Jose said he's going to rest players. Who are they going to rest? Because
He said the players that have played the most minutes in April, which if you read Squawk at lunchtime, I'm going to write that after I finish the podcast, so find out then.
Yeah, but again, so Ashley Young got injured yesterday. I just feel like he's literally down to his youth team at this point.
Yeah.
I think you're going to bring in Wayne Rooney.
Zabi might come in. And
it sounds like classic Mourinho mind games to me, especially with Wenger.
Yeah,
I mean, come on, it's Wenger. Mourinho would rather lose a Champions League final than lose to Wenger. Mm. That's how much he cares.
Yeah, I love how Wenger was like, oh, you know, we really mellowed out and respect each other. And Jose's like, no, we don't.
I hate you.
Yeah, where did this come from? Here, take a wedgie. Leave me alone.
Take a wedgie.
Just one last question on this. We had a question from Football Total, who asked, which Arsenal reserve players should be regular first team players next season, and how many players do you expect to leave the Emirates permanently?
A lot. I mean, the reality that's hitting Arsenal fans now is that they've got a Europa League level squad that's been playing at Champions League level for a few years with some exceptional players in Ozil and Sanchez.
Mm.
So there's some Europa League quality players in there. Now, in terms of the whole Arsenal decline, whether that's an issue or whatever, like that's a totally separate question. If you look at Arsenal's squad, that is potentially a Europa League winning squad with the right coaching and the right manager. They've got a lot of great assets. You look at the strike force, Sanchez, Welbeck, Giroud, there's a bit of everything there. Walcott does chip in with goals. I know he's been diabolical recently. Ramsey's a very interesting player if he's playing well. Xhaka looks very good when he's playing well. Koscielny's a very decent centre-back. Mustafi has good... It's a good squad. It is a good squad, and it could do some...
Just needs the right touches.
Needs the right touches. That's exactly right.
Mm. Before we move on to the European stuff, just to wrap up the pod, we're going to look now at our bet ball squawker accumulator for the weekend. And we've got five bets on our accumulator with a bet ball for the weekend, which we think are quite interesting. If you want to find out more, do go to squawk.at/betball. And the first one we're going for is a Hull City to beat Sunderland, Nick.
Yeah. Sunderland already down, so it's pretty much a banker. If you wanted one in your accumulator, this would probably be the one.
Mm. And Hull haven't lost a single home game under Marco Silva yet, winning 8 of their 9 games in all competitions. And as you say, Sunderland are woeful.
Are woeful. I mean, if they hadn't given up before, they've given up now.
Mm. Bit of a banker.
But then you might get those a few players who are like, I want to stay in this league, so I'm going to start playing good now. Which is like...
It's the audition.
Yeah. It's way too late to start playing good. Should have done it, you know, from September. But there might be a few players who were like, well, I have nothing to lose now. I'm going to give it my all. And this is the kind of game where Hull might walk into it going, we expect to win here. And I don't know, Jermaine Defoe might decide to be a striker again and score. It's been, 11, 12 games since he last scored a goal. So
someone was saying that Liverpool should sign Jermaine Defoe. That would be the worst idea ever.
Why would they? They don't play Daniel Sturridge. Why are they going to play Jermaine Defoe?
Exactly.
back to the accumulator.
Sorry.
Our next game is Man City to score 2+ goals versus Crystal Palace. Crystal Palace will be without Mamadou Sakho. They've won 85.7% of their games in which he's played 90 minutes this season, 6 out of 7. And just 17.8 without him. So
we didn't mention this earlier. We forgot to mention it. Crystal Palace without Sakho, they don't have a defence. That was their problem all season. Sakho's
they don't have a player who can truly pass the ball from out the back either.
Exactly. Yeah, so Sakho's a really weird, ungainly passing technique, but he works really well. And City, Guardiola will probably look at that. He's very good at reacting to team sort of build-up, so you'd expect him to go gung-ho and try and expose that Crystal Palace defence.
So that's two out of five. Our third one is Man United versus Arsenal, over 9.5 corners. Man United average 5.85 corners per Premier League game. Arsenal average 5.75. So they're both going to be hoofing that ball forward and maybe getting some corners for each other to take.
Yeah, Giroud's very good creating situations where get corners. Also, this kind of highlights the fact that both teams aren't great at crossing the ball. The only real good crosser on both sides is Antonio Valencia, which is not a sentence you'd expect to be hearing every day.
Well, he is a former winger turned wing-back.
Yeah.
Liverpool versus Southampton for our fourth bet. We're expecting over 1.5 goals in this game. No team's games have seen more goals in the Premier League this season than Liverpool, who've seen 113 goals. Not all of which they've scored themselves. And the fifth game on our accumulator, as I say, if you want to find out more, do go to squawk.at/betball, is Chelsea -1 versus Middlesbrough. Obviously, we're going to talk about this game in more depth on Monday. But Chelsea have already won 10 Premier League home games by 2 or more goals this season. Middlesbrough haven't won on the road since their first away game of the Premier League this season. So all the omens look set to be a...
Bad omens.
Bad omens.
Chelsea to turn the screw. You know, as much as it would be great to see Spurs win the title, you know, it'd be a great story. Chelsea just, they got a really easy run in, and they're very, very good side, and they've got no distractions except for an FA Cup final against the mighty Arsenal.
So do download the BetBall app and check out your own accumulator, set one up yourself, and follow us on Squawker as well. We're going to move on now just to the final wrap-up of the podcast. I'm going to quickly run through all the action across Europe's top five leagues. And the Bundesliga, the title race ended last weekend, but plenty of interest this week. Dortmund take on Hoffenheim as Tuchel takes on Nagelsmann, two of the hottest young coaches in European football, while Hamburg take on Mainz at home to try and get ahead of relegation rivals Wolfsburg, who face the DFB Pokal Cup finalist Eintracht Frankfurt. So a fascinating, dramatic weekend in German football. Serie A, it's the Turin derby. We should mention that earlier with Juventus, but Juventus take on Torino, and while Milan take on Roma. Depending if results go the right way, however, the old lady could secure the title. They're sixth in a row in Italy against their cross-city rivals.
Must be getting bored at this point.
I doubt they are.
All the trophies. Yes.
No. A quick shout-out to Nagelsmann, though. Secured qualification for Hoffenheim last weekend. He's only, like, 29 or something. It's completely absurd.
And obviously, they're in third. Dortmund in fourth. They could still finish ahead of Dortmund. And if they get the right result at the weekend in the Bundesliga, then they probably will. In Ligue 1, Monaco will look to bounce back away to Nancy. They are 3 points ahead of PSG with a game in hand after the Parisians were beaten by former title leaders Nice last weekend. PSG host Bastia, while Nice take on Marseille away, which will be another fascinating fixture in European football this weekend. In La Liga, the title race full steam ahead. Barcelona versus Real Madrid. Barcelona versus Villarreal. There's not another Clasico. Sorry. Sorry for the fake news there.
Oh, my God.
That snuck up on us. Barcelona versus Villarreal and Granada versus Real Madrid. This could probably be the weekend it turns again, looking at those fixtures. Villarreal could be quite stubborn. Granada, already down under Tony Adams. Not much to them. And Real Madrid still have a game in hand as well. So, huge weekend in Spanish football. The final wrap-up, last few questions. Ryan Baldy asks, which top six side has the most room for improvement next season in the Premier League? Very quick answers on this one.
United.
Arsenal. Yeah.
With the right coach, who knows what could happen.
Exactly.
On that question, just starting, ask who should and could be Arsenal and Barcelona's coaches next season if Wenger goes. Obviously, Luis Enrique is already going to leave Barcelona in the season.
Again, they've got another mind blank simply because I think Wenger's going to stay. So in terms of Arsenal.
All right, Barcelona, who do you reckon? There's rumours the assistant's going to take over.
I think they might just go down that road, just trying to keep it in-house.
Keep the dynasty going. Arsenal? We've got the Barcelona shout, so who are you going for, Arsenal?
I mean,
if Allegri wins the Champions League, job done.
Allegri would be ideal, but I don't know if he'll leave to go to Arsenal. To Europa League football. I don't know why he'd do that unless they offer him a ridiculous amount of money.
Kind of same story with Hardim as well. He's just literally going to win the Liga title. Why would he leave?
Yeah, I think Lucien Favre would be interesting. Nice, good with young talent. Arsenal have a fair amount of young talent. Iwobi and Bellerin sort of not progressing as well as they should.
So might be able to convince Weiland Cyprian to join them as well.
That would be interesting.
Imagine that. Owen Griffiths asks, now we're in the latter stage of Champions League, very much the latter stages, and what do the Premier League teams need to do to be competitive next season?
Be better. No, let's stop giving obvious answers to those questions. It's really hard to say. The Premier League has sort of inflated the transfer value across Europe so much that they're sort of stuck in this rut of overpaying for players. So they need to be smarter with their transfers. They need to improve their squads in that front. Also, the FA needs to really relax the schedule a bit. You can tell that during some of the knockout phase, there's so many games on. Yeah. Like, it's completely absurd. And as much as I hate defending Jose Mourinho, I mean, he had an absolutely valid point on some of that, like, fixture congestion nonsense. I mean, you can tell that Man United squad is completely depleted.
I think before Leicester played us, second leg against Atletico, they were playing on a Sunday and the game on a Tuesday. That's ridiculous.
It's completely absurd.
Surely, okay, you know, the Premier League gets all this money and stuff like that from the TV deal, but there comes a point where you say, do you know what? We need to move some of our fixtures back, playing a Friday night. Why are Spurs West Ham on a Friday night? Now, it makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Or at least the team that's in the competition, like, sort of help them out by changing the schedule a bit. Like,
I know, other countries do it.
Other countries do it. Why not?
Smarter spending and smarter scheduling, that's probably going to be one to fix in 5 years' time rather than next year. So maybe English football has a way to go to get itself back in the
condition. Yeah, absolutely, but it won't because obsessed with short-termism. Us as a country, isn't it?
Well, that's another podcast itself. Another podcast. Very last final question in the wrap-up. Hugh Woosencroft asks, who was right? Neil Custis or Ray Wilkins? If you haven't seen this, there was a bit of a debate on TalkSport earlier today. Basically, a bit of an argument over what happened with Marcus Rashford's free kick to win it for United against Celta Vigo. Do you want to give us a view on this, Nick?
Yeah, so Wilkins claims that the keeper shouldn't have moved. And Custis was saying, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
There's a little bit of a whole kind of like journalist versus ex-player thing.
It all kind of got a bit journalist ex-players, which a lot of people talking on. But what I find interesting is the fact that it's very symptomatic of mass media sort of debate is that there was no room for either party moving on their opinion at all. There was no actual debate. It was just, it descended into mudslinging. And like name calling so incredibly quickly when you consider that this is a free kick by like probably the hottest talent in English football. You know, we can't just agree that, okay, it was a great hit, but maybe the keeper was a bit wrong. You know, maybe there's two sides to the argument. The fact that we can't do that with like just a free kick, I mean, it's just so like representative of like general mass media debate.
Again, another podcast though.
Another podcast entirely, but I think the point's valid. And also, I think it's remarkable that we're in a situation where basically it's just a bunch of like old white blokes just tearing chunks out of each other, and you know,
Nick, me and you will be old one day, mate.
Yeah, I know this is laced in irony, right? I know that. I'm fully aware of it, but just like it's just ridiculous and pathetic, the whole thing. Both of them were just completely embarrassed themselves on national radio.
I kind of want to put this to you. I often think this as a journalist, a football journalist, or at least one that's pretending to be one. I would never critique the technique of a player on the pitch or go into the real nitty gritty technical details because I've never been a player. And I don't want to do the whole kind of like show us your medals before you can talk about football type thing. But what do you make of that? Would you ever feel comfortable kind of going into kind of forensic detail on what a player's doing with their feet and all that kind of stuff?
I can barely walk down the street without tripping over, so I probably wouldn't. No, I think, well, Wilkins was right. The keeper should have saved it. I used to play in goal when I was younger. And
you do have the medals.
I lost the cup final 2 weeks ago on penalties down to 10 men. It was so bad. Shout out Hornchurch Town. I think
respect.
Wilkins was right. The keeper should have saved it. You know, he set up his ball. You don't move. It was like one of those old playground free kicks where someone runs over it. And like, I was expecting that the whole main acting to all run over it before someone actually hit it, because that's what it looked like. But then I think Wilkins was just really, really rude when he came out and said, you have no football knowledge. Mm. And if I was Curtis, I'd be like to them, why did you call me up? Surely you called me up to get my opinion on this. Yeah. If I don't have any, then please don't call me up.
It's just
like,
obnoxious both sides.
Yeah, it was hilarious, like, listening to you. I woke up this morning and I was like, this is brilliant, thank you very much. But no, they were both right, they were both wrong. They both need to shut up and grow up.
Yeah. Well, I just want to see the debate. Just some debate would be fantastic instead of just being like, here's my opinion. No, here's my opinion. Oh, well, I'm going
to
hang
and
up.
And that's why you're listening to the Squawker Talker.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, thank you very much. We have got to wrap up there, unfortunately. We could probably go on for a whole long, much more than... I can't even talk. I'm so done on this at this point. We run out of time, unfortunately. This is the end of the podcast. Nick, thanks for coming in. You're going to be hosting another show next week, aren't you?
Yeah, looking forward to it. Please join us then.
Absolutely. And Kadeem, thanks for coming in once again. Anything happened with the Morning Star this week you want to be plugging to us all?
We have a fundraiser next Saturday in Camden, I believe, Saturday the 13th, after the Women's FA Cup final. I don't have the details on me, but...
But you're on Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah. I am on Twitter, at Kadeem Simmons, so I will post a link to that. I think it's £10 a ticket. It would be amazing if you could come, because I will be there, and we can talk about football and argue like little children.
Mm. Get involved.
No guarantee that Custis and Wilkins will be there, but maybe.
Maybe.
But thank you for joining us. Join us again next week, and see you.